So I'm not sure how long this lecture is going to be. We could be finished in 10 minutes, though I doubt that. And if we're not finished at the end of the 50, there are some things that I've reserved for the end of the lecture that I definitely do want to get said. I don't know if you've noticed, there are times when the last point or two that I appeared to have been preparing to make never did get made. But in this case, I want to make sure that they are made, so that if I don't finish today, or if I still have a point or two to make, I'll definitely be taking up those points at the beginning of Thursday's lecture. All right, now, the African-American tradition of literary production is rich and long-standing. As Henry Louis Gates tells you, the first really rather important poet in the tradition, Phyllis Wheatley, is an American colonial writer. The flourishing of the slave narrative form begins in the 18th century, continues into the 19th. The 19th century witnesses extraordinary works of fiction, and in the 20th century, of course, most conspicuously in the Harlem Renaissance, but throughout the century, there has been extraordinary work done in the African-American literary tradition. It's a very rich tradition, in other words, somewhat in contrast with the very rich but also very recent tradition of African-American literary theory and criticism. It's possible to argue that the development of theory and criticism in this tradition was somewhat balked by a preliminary way in which it found itself at odds with itself. Black criticism and black feminist criticism from the beginning saw that they didn't have quite the same agenda. This is something that can resonate perhaps later in this lecture when we move to other topics. But in the meantime, critics like Barbara Christian, Barbara Smith, Deborah McDowell, Hazel Carby, bell hooks were in their variety of ways working with emphases that other and sort of typically male African American critics weren't quite comfortable with. And so while work, especially beginning in the 80s, proliferated, there was, as I say, a kind of internal divide, which has been a complex matter to negotiate, and which is, I think, now largely sort of a détente has been achieved, and African-American literary theory is moving forward unfettered any longer by these concerns, or at least by any excess of these concerns. But in the meantime, that may partly account for a certain delay in the emergence of theory and criticism, given the sort of long-standing richness of the literary tradition. Now, the role of Henry Louis Gates in African-American criticism is, it seems to me, exemplary, although there are some rather harsh moments in this essay, moments that I wish to take up, that would suggest an element of, what shall I say, extremism or overkill in Gates's thinking. This is actually not at all the persona that he has projected. And indeed, what's extraordinary about Gates, whose administrative power, whose abilities as a program builder, as we say, are remarkable. After he left Yale to go to Harvard, he was able to gather to Harvard Anthony Appiah, Cornel West, and others who have since departed from Harvard. But Gates is, in a way, an empire unto himself. And he has been an extraordinary figure. The earliest work, which is actually sort of among the earliest work, is what you've been reading for today, established his reputation together with his discovery of, not so much discovery of, but authentication of a manuscript by Harriet Wilson, which he published, an important contribution to 19th century, our knowledge of 19th century African-American literature. In any case, what happened then was that Gates, who by some miracle or other, he was a perfectly good writer in the first place, but gradually became a marvelous writer, began writing for The New Yorker. And during this phase of his career, when, among other things, he produced a remarkable autobiography about growing up in West Virginia, during this phase, Gates really became a spokesperson for a detente among races and racial factions. In other words, he was a voice of moderation without incurring any imputation of Uncle Tomism or anything of the sort. His sheer urbanity as the remarkable writer that he is in those years when he wrote under Tina Brown for The New Yorker was just a remarkable achievement, and his career is still going strong. Now, for Gates, as for Elaine Showalter last week, and for Wolfe before her, the problems surrounding the concept of identity persist. Identity, which of course is an important anchor for the thinking of people who feel the need for voices, for a place in the literary and cultural horizon, is nevertheless, at least potentially, as we've begun to notice already, a kind of quicksand. There are two problems, really, that dog the issue of identity. One of them is the problem of essentializing, which I'll take up now, and then, as I'll take it up next, also the problem of what might be called the identity cue. In other words, I am a lower class black lesbian feminist whose nation is Palestine. Needless to say, I have a variety of identity options to choose from, but the result is I've got to figure out which of them has priority. In other words, which of those identities do I suppose has the underlying integrity and essence, essentiality, that can motivate, as it were, the characteristics of my other identities, which are therefore somehow or another placed further down the queue. So this is a topic that I'll come back to in a minute. But in the meantime, the problem of essentializing, as we say, as we call it, for example, as Gates describes it on page 1893 in the right-hand column, where he's very clear on the dangers of ascribing, whether positively or negatively, attributes to any group that is constituted as or thought of, because of course the notion of race and whether there is race is in itself, according to Gates, problematic. The problem of ascribing attributes, even honorifically, to a race is, as he describes it on page 1893, the sense of difference defined in popular usages, finally, my voice is changing. The sense of difference defined in popular usages of the term race has been used both to describe and inscribe differences of language, belief system, artistic tradition, gene pool, and all sorts of supposedly natural attributes, such as rhythm, athletic ability, cerebration, usury, and fidelity. In other words, obviously apportioning out stereotypes to the various groups that may come forward as candidates to be races, and pointing out that all of these stereotypes do nobody very much good. So the problem of essentializing, which undergirds the wish to make manifest the existence of race. Because think about it. On the other hand, Gates seems to be divided in the beginning of his essay between a certain candor about race, as in the work of Hippolyte Taine that he describes, in which race, milieu, and cultural moment are considered the key determining issues of any kind of artistic or cultural production. He says, well, at least race is being talked about, while at the same time obviously wincing away from the implications of race and from the belief that there is such a thing as race, which goes all the way back to Montesquieu and others. In 10, nevertheless, he's rather cheerful about the fact that at least race is being discussed, unlike the 20th century, when the whole thing is swept under the rug and a kind of ersatz and hypocritical politeness prevents anybody from talking about such categories at all and gives rise to the idea that we all exist in the same great tradition, that work either belongs to that tradition or, if it for some reason seems egregious or outside the tradition, it just can be shoved aside and neglected. That's the supposition of the 20th century when folks don't talk about race. And so, you know, the very question whether it is an issue is part of this problem that is dogged by the more complicated issue of essentializing. For example, suppose as, and of course you've been reading about this in Showalter as well, suppose you ascribe positive value to what another person might call a stereotype. This is what the important Francophone African poet Sangar does, as Gates says at the top of page 1901, the right-hand column. Gates says, when we attempt to appropriate by inversion race as a term for an essence, as did the negritude movement, for example, we feel, therefore we are, as Sangar argued of the African, we yield too much, such as the basis of a shared humanity. Such gestures, as Anthony Appiah has observed, are futile and dangerous because of their further inscription of new and bizarre stereotypes. So you can see there are a lot of landmines to be avoided in negotiating the discourse of race, and certainly Gates is aware of them. Now, there's also the problem, as I say, of the identity cue. And Gates himself may have a little difficulty with this, at least from time to time, because, as I said at the beginning, he does have this sort of uneasy détente with feminism in the African-American critical tradition still to work within. And so, for example, on page 1894, a somewhat problematic passage in which the identity cue seems to be at issue, about a third of the way down the left-hand column. He says, the sanction of biology contained in sexual difference, simply put, does not and can never obtain when one is speaking of racial difference. Yet, we carelessly use language in such a way as to will this sense of natural difference into our formulations. So what he's saying is, in biological terms, there's definitely a difference between the sexes. But in biological terms, there is not necessarily a difference among the so-called primary races. So that, at least when one speaks of women and men in the feminist tradition, one has to come face to face with it, with the problem of actual difference. Whereas when one speaks of black and white in the traditions of discourse about race, one isn't actually talking about a genuine difference at all. And therefore the discourse with the greater integrity of the two is the one which is about differences that are absolutely ephemeral, as opposed to the one which is about differences which, whatever one thinks of them and whatever one wants to make out of them, are nevertheless essential. Now, plainly, when we go back to feminist criticism, particularly the gender theory of Judith Butler, we'll see, of course, that the whole question of the biological basis of sex, the biological difference between the sexes, which essentializes what we will be wanting to talk about, is, of course, something that is profoundly in question, and not just because of so-called transgender issues, but also at the same time because of the way in which our very sexual identity is something which, according to Butler, we construct. And so there is an insistence here on biological difference between these two forms of discussing identity, which may or may not seem to us to be problematic. Now, I think this is the point at which we can see the importance of the extraordinary essay that I've also asked you to read by Toni Morrison. You know her best, of course, as a novelist, but she's also a distinguished critic, as she has been a distinguished editor of other important work. And here, it seems to me that her reflections in some ways give us a sideways exit from the predicaments that I've been talking about, the problem of essentialism, the problem of the identity cue. Because what Morrison wants to say, and I think she borrows here particularly from the famous discussion of the master-slave dialectic in Hegel's Phenomenology of Mind, what Morrison wants to say is that identity isn't so much a question of what something is, but rather a question of what it is not. She says, it's not that we should be so much preoccupied with what it is to be black, but rather, as we think about the way in which being black is inscribed within the white tradition, as we think about that, we need to think about what white is not. In other words, as she says repeatedly, about black as absence, as negation, as negativity, and we have to understand the absolute, and this is where she derives her argument from the master-slave dialectic, the absolute necessity in the construction of white identity for there to be, as an absence, as a lack, over against white identity, the existence of the African American, and more particularly, for the better part of the American cultural tradition, of the slave. Let me quote then from her essay on page 1795, left-hand column, where she says, construction of black, this is third of the way down, construction of blackness and enslavement could be found not only not free, but also the projection of the not me. The result was a playground for the imagination. What rose up out of collective needs to allay internal fears and rationalize external exploitation was an Africanism, a fabricated brew of darkness, otherness, alarm, and desire that is uniquely American. And then she points out that although her subject is the American tradition, there also exists a European Africanism with its counterpart in its own colonial literature. To reinforce this, she takes a remarkable example, which must have reminded you, those of you who know Faulkner, of Thomas Sutpen, at least reminded you in some ways of Thomas Sutpen, of this character Dunbar, who actually rose up not so much out of the swamp as out of the Scottish Enlightenment, and came to the United States, and according to Bernard Balin, the historian from whom she takes this information, who became a transformed character. I won't quote to you the long passage from Balin's text, which makes what Morrison wants to take from it clear, but rather from what Morrison summarizes of it on page 1796, the top of the right-hand column. I take, says Morrison, William Dunbar to be a succinct portrait of the process by which the American as new, white, and male was constituted. It is a formation that has several attractive consequences, all of which are referred to in Balin's summation of Dunbar's character and located in how Dunbar feels within himself a power, a sense of freedom he had not known before. This is uncannily parallel, by the way, to the rationalization for slaves in Greek culture. The Greeks always said that the reason they had slaves was so they could be free. In other words, so that the home or ruling population was liberated, in the case of the Greeks, from performing the daily necessities of that are life-sustaining and keep us going. In other words, to be free, according to the citizen of the Greek polis, is to be free from work. Now, in a certain way, this is still a rationalization that Toni Morrison sees in the American slave-owning tradition. But it's not so much in the case of this Dunbar, of freedom from work. It's the case of a more broad and insidious idea of freedom, freedom from responsibility, freedom from the need to acknowledge otherness as human, freedom, in other words, from the sorts of constraint imposed by old world civility in Scotland and in London, freedom on this frontier, in this wilderness, in this swamp, simply to be whatever one wants to be. And that freedom is achieved on the backs of the black slave. It is in some ways similar, as I say, to the rationalization for slavery in Greece, but it is in a way more insidious and certainly more, in the terms that Morrison's giving it to us in, more dialectical. That is to say, it is the question whether a person could become white without the availability of a black absence, of that which can be oppressed like a kind of spring for the Jack in the Box, which allows the white Jack in the Box to leap out of the box because of that which is suppressed down below. All of that is part of Toni Morrison's concern, and it colors her, well, certainly controversial reading of Huckleberry Finn, which nevertheless, it seems to me, has a quite profound interest. Now, my own first instinct when people single out Huckleberry Finn is to wince away, because it's an extraordinary novel. The controversy about it in the school districts, which made it a banished book, had mainly to do with the N-word, to which we'll return. The question, who has the right to use the N-word, which is not an easy question to answer, as we'll see. But that controversy, while it had an authentic basis, was nevertheless, certainly in literary terms and in terms of the imagination, perhaps rather limited. Morrison gives rise to another equally and intensely critical way of thinking about Huckleberry Finn. She argues that to liberate Jim, which of course is the tremendous failure at the end of the novel, a failure of imagination on the part of Tom Sawyer, a failure of will or independence of mind on the part of Huck himself, that the failure to liberate Jim, which would have been the easiest thing in the world, all they had to do was point out the right fork in the river, is an absolute necessity for the ongoing self-definition of whiteness as it's available both to Tom and to Huck, and after all, by implication, to Mark Twain himself. He couldn't figure out how to end the novel. He wrote it. It lay on his desk for a long time because he just couldn't figure out what to do with it. And he finally comes up with this, as we all agree, appalling ending. Toni Morrison says it's the only ending available. It's the only ending available because in ways that the, as she sees it, sentimentality of the novel, the sentimentality of the relationship between Huck and Jim, which is so strong that it caused another critic named Leslie Fiedler to talk about a homoerotic relation between them. The title of Fiedler's famous essay is "Come Up on Giraffe, Huck, Honey." With all that in the background, Toni Morrison says the basic structure of consciousness in Twain's novel is obscured. A basic structure which makes it absolutely imperative that Jim not be freed. If Jim is freed, then there is no other over against which whiteness can define itself. That's the way in which she makes use of the general argument about the traditions of American literature and culture in applying it to Huckleberry Finn. All right, let's go back to Skip Gates. Oh. Henry Louis Gates, sorry. Another person who was at Yale and whom I knew very well. I actually had a little bit to do with the origin of the notion of the signifying monkey. I'll come back to that later. Barbara Johnson, also now at Harvard, and I had a lot of conversations with Skip at that period about this. And so it's not that I feel proprietary, it's Skip's idea, but I was in on that. It's not just name dropping. I get to call him by what his friends call him. So in any case, it is, however, I'll try to remember to say Henry Louis Gates. In any case, to return to him, I want to talk a little bit about before moving on to this crucial central issue. I want to talk a little bit simply about his understanding and the understanding of other African American tradition critics, both of the critical tradition and of the literary tradition. First of all, the grasp of the critical tradition as basically a two-step or two-part progression is something that he shares with Elaine Showalter from last time. You remember, Showalter says that the important movement of feminist interventions in literary criticism begins with the moment that she calls feminist, that is to say, the moment of Kate Millett and other authors who talk about the degradation and unfair treatment of women in male books. And then what Showalter prefers and supposes to have supervened and to have become more important, gynocritical criticism, which is women's appropriation of literary traditions for themselves, the archival work that makes the canon of women's literature not just a leaping from great name to great name, but an actual unfolding and continuous development from decade to decade, as Showalter puts it. Now, Gates, on page 1896, the right-hand margin, sees it in much the same way for the development of African-American criticism. You can do two things, basically, says Gates. He doesn't put them chronologically, but you could see, you could map onto what he's saying here the same chronological sequence. He says, what I mean by citing these two overworked terms, he's talking about the other in particular, is precisely this. How blacks are figures in literature, that is to say, how they're represented in literature, demeaningly, even perhaps honorifically, how blacks are figured in literature, and also how blacks figure, as it were, literature of their own making. You can see, in other words, the same movement in his thinking about these issues. Now, as Showalter argued, the question of the literary tradition is more complicated. It has more steps. In other words, the powers of self-expression available to women from the beginning of their creative expression pass through more than just two stages. And the same thing is true of African-American literature. Now, I think that Gates simply takes for granted as an implicit premise the work that was done the year before he published this essay in Critical Inquiry by another colleague of ours here at Yale, who died tragically not too long thereafter, named Michael Cook, who in 1984 wrote a book called African American Literature in the 20th Century, The Achievement of Intimacy. And Cook argued in his book that the history of African American literature passes essentially through four stages. It begins with what Cook calls self-veiling. The period, in other words, in which people attempting for the first time to write, and of course Gates talks about the way in which writing is really writing oneself into the human community for black people, the people who first attempted to write used white models. Phyllis Wheatley, the poet whom Gates talks about, a remarkable poet and a very interesting one, nevertheless wrote in the manner of Alexander Pope. So much so that a great deal of her work is almost impossible, which is, of course, you know, a point of praise, almost impossible to distinguish from that of Alexander Pope. So she is an instance of the first phase, which Cook calls self-veiling. Second phase, which Cook calls solitude, involves continuing to use white models, a white prose style, a way of narrating, which is obviously derived from white teachers and white models, but which nevertheless involves as its central theme self-definition. Here, you might want to think of Douglass and of slave narratives in general, where the emphasis is on being taught by white people, but nevertheless, the tension which exists and which founds and governs the possibility of self-liberation and self-freedom. In other words, the slave narrative as an ongoing form partakes of this second phase in the development of African-American literature as Cook understands it. Thirdly, there's what Cook calls kinship. A literature in which African Americans reach out to each other, identify themselves as a community and not as individuals struggling to be free, but rather as a community. And Cook identifies this phase with the experimentation with dialect and a way of narrating and poetizing, which involves a self-conscious insistence on verbal and linguistic difference. You can think of many of the poems, for example, of Langston Hughes in this regard, and of a great deal else that goes on in the Harlem Renaissance. So that's the third phase, kinship. And then the last phase, and what I'm going to want to say is that Gates doesn't think we've reached this. In other words, the point of disagreement between Cook and Gates is precisely about this. The last phase, which Cook calls intimacy, is the freedom to expropriate any and all models. Not, in other words, to insist necessarily on one's own creative paradigms. As a racial tradition, to expropriate anything that comes ready to hand. Ellison's Invisible Man, for example, is a masterpiece of high modernism. It takes freely, in other words, from whatever traditions come to hand and are most readily available for the kind of work that Ellison wants to do. Cook identifies this, perhaps rather optimistically, with what he calls intimacy. In other words, a merger, a finally achieved merger of traditions such that, and this is plainly the ideal of Virginia Woolf as well, such that one no longer has to write as a spokesperson. One no longer needs to be concerned for thematizing the kinds of identity that out of which one's writing has arisen. One can write just anything one wants to. In other words, the utopian vision of no matter who I am, having access to absolutely any forms and themes I care to work with. That is the vision of Michael Cook, which Gates, I think, unfortunately, rightly feels that we haven't quite arrived at. And that's why I deliberately used the word expropriate in talking about Cook's fourth phase. If I use models other than models made available by my own tradition, I'm not just kind of pulling them out of the air. I'm using them with a calculated purpose. I always have something in mind in choosing the model that I choose. we're not really quite at intimacy, because self-definition is still at issue. You can talk about the high modernism of the invisible man all you like, but think of what the invisible man is about. The invisible man is still about what it means to be black. You know, what is it? So what is passing? What does it mean, in other words, to have this racial identity? So that, yeah, traditions, manners, styles have been expropriated, but at the same time, the business of writing as an African American continues. And it is as much, after all, a question of self-definition as it has been hitherto. So that, as Gates sees it, continues to be the issue. We use other models. We need to make them our own. Otherwise, we're just colonized by them. And after all, we're back in phase one, right? We're back in self-veiling because, after all, Phyllis Wheatley used other models. Phyllis Wheatley actually aspired to the idea that she was just a poet. She could write about anything she wanted to write about. The Tears of Niobe and the painting by Richard Wilson, whatever it might be, she could write about it because she was just a poet. That was her great aspiration, was to be received not as, that amazing thing, a young black slave woman who could write. She wasn't interested in that. She wanted to be a poet. And so in a certain sense, you can see the problem. If intimacy is achieved in the fourth phase, well, then that's finally just the realization of what Phyllis Wheatley wanted in the first phase. And we have to admit, for all of the complicated reasons that these critics go into, that this is not a moment which can be said yet to have been achieved. Okay, now this brings us to Gates's key concept. What does it mean, and what is the advantage of to expropriate other people's traditions, more particularly the white tradition? And here, Gates is, after all, thinking primarily about criticism. How can we do theory and criticism in the white man's language? How can we expropriate for ourselves the white man's language? And the necessity of bending language to one's own purposes is what is emphasized in the remarkable epigraph on page 1891 that Gates takes from Bakhtin. This is, it seems to me, as central a passage in Bakhtin, by the way, as anything that we studied when we were actually reading Bakhtin. And I'd like you to make note of it, because I think it really can illuminate a great deal that's going on in Bakhtin that we didn't perhaps fully articulate at the time. This is what Bakhtin says. Language, for the individual consciousness, lies on the borderline between oneself and the other. The word in language is half someone else's. To become one's own, only when it becomes one's own, only when the speaker populates it with his own intention, his own accent. And you can hear Gates wanting to emphasize that word accent. His own accent. When he appropriates the word, adapting it to his own semantic and expressive intention. Prior to this moment of appropriation, the word does not exist in a neutral and impersonal language. It is not, after all, out of a dictionary that the speaker gets his words. You know, how true, how true. It is not, after all, out of a dictionary that the speaker gets his words, but rather it exists in other people's mouths, in other people's contexts, serving other people's intentions. It is from there that one must take the word and make it one's own. Now, actually, during the course of his essay, Gates echoes this sentiment of Bakhtin by quoting Derrida at the very top of the right-hand column on page 1901, where he says, we must master, as Derrida wrote, how to speak the other's language without renouncing our own. Now, how do you do this? How do you set about taking the language you are given? And this isn't, of course, just a question of the difference between the races. It's a question of all of us in relation to each other. As Bakhtin says in what you have already read, most of the time we're speaking other people's languages. It is rare indeed that we can say, feeling very much like creative writers when we do so, that we've somehow wrenched other people's language out of its conventional usages and made it our own, slightly rewritten it so that it is truly our own. So, more broadly speaking, this is the challenge that faces a theoretical tradition, or a theoretical enterprise, I should say, that doesn't want to be just derivative from what other folks have already said. The concept that Gates brings to bear on this, because after all, he recognizes, as does Showalter too, that the notion of the sign is probably the cornerstone of white male literary theory. He recognizes that in order to perform this expropriative act, he's got to do something with the notion of the sign. And so he talks about the way in which one can signify on something. He introduces it very quietly on page 1900, the right-hand column, just seemingly in passing, near the top of the right-hand column, since writing, according to Hume, was the ultimate sign of difference between animal and human, these writers implicitly were signifying upon the figure of the chain itself. Notice the accent. You don't necessarily pronounce the G. They were signifying on the chain. And of course, the great chain of being, which is hierarchical, is very different from the vertical chain of the chain gang, isn't it? It's very difficult. It's very different from the chain that holds slaves together. That's part of what it means to signify on something. The signifier, at least allegedly, the signifier in the white male theoretical tradition is just a kind of placeholder in a play of linguistic differences. The question of the underlying sociological and cultural basis of this play and of the way in which this play takes shape isn't taken into account, again, allegedly, because, well, you know, in ways that you can probably grasp from what we've said all along, this is slightly to oversimplify, but this is the position taken up. And in any case, you therefore need to take the signifier and signify on it. Well, what is it to signify on something? This is an expression that Gates takes from the trickster tradition, the tradition of African storytelling in which the weaker is also the smarter, and the monkey, or Ananke the spider. Some of you may remember the songs of Raffi from your childhood about Ananke the spider, in which the monkey or the spider tricks the big bad guys, the elephant, the lion. All the bad guys get tricked because they're stupider. And the little guy is always able to signify on them, to trick them, to lie to them, without their realizing what's going on. And this way of talking about signifying is very much in the tradition of African-American folklore and first comes to public consciousness in a song by the scat singer Oscar Brown Jr., written by Oscar Brown Jr., called The Signifying Monkey. If I could sing, I'd sing it to you. Fortunately, I can't sing, but you can. It became extremely popular and was picked up by various instrumental jazz groups and was a staple in the jazz tradition of the 50s and 60s. In any case, Oscar Brown Jr.'s notion of the signifying monkey is where Gates takes his essay's title from, and which is where he gets this idea of taking somebody else's discourse out of its context and insisting on bending it into an African-American context. In other words, a context which is one's own and not just the context one is given. Now, the other example of signifying on that Gates gives is the culminating example of the color purple and the conversation about getting the man out of your eye, which is a way of taking back a problem that exists even within the African-American tradition. As Gates has been pointing out, Wheatley and later Rebecca Cox, or rather Rebecca Jackson, take their models of education and self-development from white male figures who have taught them how to read. And in each case, of course, this is pernicious because the existence of the white male figure is very much still in your eye. You got to get the man out of your eye, at least according to the dialogue Gates quotes from The Color Purple. Well, the interesting thing there is that in a way, the issue of feminist criticism comes back to haunt Gates's argument, because plainly, Shug doesn't just mean the white man when she says the man. A big issue in The Color Purple, of course, is the emergence of a possible feminism from social constructions that aren't just defined by race. So that when Gates says, you know, the man, which all of us recognize as shorthand for the white man, can be signified on by an African-American tradition, making it a term of opprobrium, right? Get the man out of your eye. At the same time, it can be signified on by the feminist tradition, making it a term of opprobrium, not in a completely different way, but in an overlapping and partially different way. And Gates, in emphasizing the one as opposed to the other, is perhaps tilting again toward a certain imbalance. Now, finally, I want to take up the example, the most controversial example in his essay, one which is a source of outrage for most readers, at the bottom of page 1893 in the left-hand column. He's been talking about the new agrarian moment, out of which there emerged a number of figures associated with the new criticism, including Robert Penn Warren, who very early on repudiated the new agrarians and became a politically progressive figure in his own writing. Many of you have probably read All the King's Men, certainly in his poetry as well, but who was an avatar, a central figure in the development of the thinking of the new criticism, which we have briefly studied. Now, Warren wrote a poem called Pondy Woods, which is quoted completely out of context by Sterling Brown, and unfairly out of context, in the passage, which I'm not going to read because I don't think I have the right to speak the N-word, and so I'll just have you look at it. But then, and I'll come back to that in a minute, and then the Sterling Brown's response is also recorded there for you. Well, the problem is this, from the standpoint of anybody who's actually read the poem. But remember, in some ways, it's a problem raised by a new critical perspective. And I'll explain what I mean in a minute. That expression is spoken by a buzzard or vulture from, I forget whether it's Tennessee or Kentucky. The episode takes place in northern Louisiana. And the buzzard is sitting expectantly on a tree, waiting for a fugitive slave who has been chased into the swamp by his white pursuers to die. And the vulture is sitting there, well, if it could, it would be rubbing its hands with glee, waiting for this to take place. And it's the vulture that says it in the poem. Nothing to do, in other words, as we say, with the author of the poem, Warren, who is writing a completely sympathetic evocation of what it's like to be a fugitive slave in this state of terrible and overwhelmed panic. And so it seems completely unfair. And it is, I think, unfair as Sterling Brown took it up and as Gates then perpetuates the idea in his own reference. The one thing I would add, however, is that it's a new critical idea that we invoke to say that it's unfair. It's the new criticism of which Robert Penn Warren was a participant that tells us we shouldn't confuse speakers in poems with authors. In other words, an author is someone, according to the new criticism, who's dispassionate and who introduces dramatic voices, even in lyric poems, voices with which we are merely confusing ourselves if we associate them with an author. Now, this is something that we just take for granted when we read poems. All poems for us are, to some degree, dramatic monologues on the model of Browning and others in the 19th century. We read them that way now. But it is, as I say, a new critical idea. And it comes back to the question, who has the right to use the N-word? It's a frequent sort of term used on the street, as you know, in African-American culture, used almost with a certain fondness as a form of mutual greeting. But at the same time, it is a term that continues rigorously to be rejected as available to anyone other than someone who belongs within this community. And so that issue lingers. It's an issue that Warren, because of course he wrote long before this sort of controversy began to arise around the word, the controversy really boiled over precisely at the time of the banning of Huckleberry Finn from public schools. And so there's a kind of innocence, perhaps, in Warren's use of the word. But nevertheless, in the critical tradition, it's a question, who has the right to use it? And this gives rise, perhaps, to the suggestion of a certain insularity in the thinking of the new criticism. Use any model you like, the model of the Freudian unconscious, the model of the political unconscious. In other words, we've been reading a lot in this course about our never quite saying what we mean to say, of our never quite being fully in control of our discourse because it bubbles up from the unconscious, right? Now, if you take a model like this, even though it's a nasty buzzard from Kentucky that's saying what Gates quotes, nevertheless, there is an author, and it has bubbled up from the unconscious of that. Well, what are you going to do with that? There's a kind of impasse there. We feel distinctly and vividly and even bitterly, because I love Warren, I love Pondy Woods, and I also am something of a new critic, so we feel a bitterness about the expropriation, the signifying on what Warren says in this fashion. But at the same time, we have entertained these ideas of a subliminal author, not an authority, but an author welling up from below. And if that's the case, then we have to worry a little bit about how an expression like that got into the poem afterwards, after all. And so that, too, I call it a lingering problem because it strikes me as one of those moments when probably would have been better if Gates hadn't followed Sterling Brown, one of those moments when there is a kind of overkill in the zeal of argumentation, but which at the same time we can't absolutely dismiss out of hand for the variety of reasons that I've mentioned. Okay, I'll leave it like at there, and we'll return to many of these issues in a new vocabulary and in new forms when we read the examples of post-colonial criticism on Thursday that you've been assigned.